Volyova's shuttle was approaching a shipyard, up near the Lagrange point between Yellowstone and its moon, Marco's Eye. About a dozen light huggers were parked in the yard, more ships than Curry had ever seen in her life. At the yard's hub was a major carousel, smaller in-system vessels attached to the wheel's rim like suckling pigs. A few of the light huggers were encased in skeletal support structures for major ice shield or conjoiner drive overhauls. Conjoiner ships were here, too, sleek and black, as if chiseled from space itself. But the rest of the starships were basically drifting, following lazy and slow orbits around the Lagrange point center of gravity. Curry guessed that there must be complex rules of etiquette governing the way those ships were parked. Who had to move out of the way for whom to avoid a collision, which a computer might predict days in advance? The expenditure of fuel which might have to be burned to nudge a ship off a collision course would be tiny against the profit margin of a typical trade stopover. But the loss of face would be much harder to amortize. There had never been as many ships as this parked around Sky's Edge, but even then she had heard of skirmishes between crews over issues of parking priority and trade rights. It was a common groundsider's misapprehension that ultras were a homogeneous splinter of humanity. In truth, they were as factional and as paranoid about one another as any other human strain. Now they were approaching Volyova's ship. The Thing, like all the other light huggers, was improbably streamlined. Space only approximated a vacuum at slow speeds. Up near light speed, which was where these ships spent most of their time, it was like cutting through a howling gale of atmosphere. That was why they looked like daggers, conic hull tapering to a needle-sharp prow to punch the interstellar medium, with two conjoiner engines braced at the back on spars like an ornate hilt. The ship was sheathed in ice, so glisteningly pure that it looked like diamond. The shuttle swooped in low over Volyova's ship, and for a moment Curry apprehended the ship's vastness. It was like flying over a city, not another vessel. Then a door irised open in the hull, revealing a glowing docking bay. Volyova guided the shuttle home with expert taps on her thruster controls, latching on to a berthing cradle. Curry heard thumps as umbilicals and docking connectors thudded home. Volyova was first out of her seat restraints. "Shall we step aboard?" she asked, with something that was not quite the politeness Curry had been expecting. They propelled themselves through the shuttle and out into the spacious environment of the ship. They were still in freefall, but at the end of the corridor they were facing, Curry could see a complex arrangement where the stationary and rotating sections were joined together. She was beginning to feel nauseous, but she was damned if she was going to let Volyova see this. "Before we go ahead," the ultra woman said, "there's someone you have to meet." She was looking over Curry's shoulder, back towards the corridor that led to the shuttle which had brought them aboard. Curry heard the shuffling sound of someone working hand over hand along the rails which ribbed the passage, but that could only mean that there had been another person aboard the shuttle. Something was wrong here. Volyova's attitude was not that of someone who was trying to impress a potential recruit. It was more as if she cared little what Curry thought, as if it was of no consequence at all. Curry looked around, in time to see the Komuso who had come with them in the elevator. His face was lost under the expressionless wicker helmet they all wore. He carried his shakuhachi in the crook of his arm. Curry started to speak, but Volyova silenced her. "Welcome aboard the Nostalgia for Infinity, Anna Curry. You've just become our new gunnery officer." Then she nodded toward the Komuso. "Do me a favor, will you, Triumvir? Anything particular? Knock her out before she tries to kill either one of us." The last thing Curry saw was a golden blur of bamboo. Sylvestre thought he smelt Pascal's perfume before his eyes separated her from the crowd outside the prison building. He made a reflex move towards her, but the two burly militiamen who had escorted him from his room quickly restrained him. Catcalls and muffled insults came from the cordoned-off crowd, but Sylvestre barely noticed them. Pascal kissed him diplomatically, half hiding the conjunction of their mouths behind her lace-gloved hand. "Before you ask," she said, her voice barely audible above the noise of the crowd, "I have no more idea what this is about than you. Is Nils behind it? Who else? Only he's got the clout to get you out of that place for more than a day. Pity he's not so keen to prevent me returning. Oh, he might, if he didn't have to placate his own people and the opposition. It's about time you stopped thinking of him as your worst enemy, you know. They stepped into the sterile hush of the waiting car. The vehicle was adapted from one of the smaller surface exploration buggies, four balloon wheels at the extremities of its air-smoothed body, comms gear stowed in a matte black hump on the roof. It was painted inundationist purple, with Hokusai wave pendants mounted on the front. If it wasn't for my father, Pascal continued, you'd have died during the coup. He protected you from your worst enemies. That doesn't make him a very competent revolutionary. And what does that say about the regime he managed to overthrow? Sylvestre shrugged. Fair point, I suppose. A guard climbed into the front seat, behind a partition of armored glass, and then they were moving, rushing through the crowd, speeding toward the edge of the city. They passed through one of the arboreta, then descended down one of the ramps which passed beneath the perimeter. Two other government cars accompanied them, also modified from surface buggies, but painted black and with masked militia riding postillion, holding rifles to their shoulders. After traveling for a kilometer along an unlit tunnel, the convoy arrived in an airlock and halted while the breathable city air was exchanged for Resurgam's atmosphere. The guards remained at their posts, pausing only to adjust their breather masks and goggles. Then the vehicles moved on, ascending back towards the surface. They arrived in grayish daylight, surrounded by concrete blast walls, driving across a surface patterned in red and green lights. An aircraft was waiting for them, parked on the apron on a tripod of skids, the undersides of its wings already uncomfortably bright to look at, already beginning to ionize the boundary layer of air below them. The driver reached into a dashboard compartment and removed breather masks, passing them back through the security grill, motioning for them to place them over their faces. "Not that you have to," he said. "Oxygen's up 200% since you were last outside Resurgam City, Dr. Sylvestre. Some people have breathed naked atmosphere for tens of minutes with no long-term effects."
"Those must be the dissidents I keep hearing about," Sylvestre said.
"The renegades Girardieu betrayed during the coup. The ones that are supposed to be communicating with Troop Path's leaders in Cuvier. I don't envy them. The dust must clog their lungs almost as much as it clogs their minds."
The escort looked unimpressed.
"Scavenger enzymes process the dust particles. It's old Martian biotech. Anyway, dust levels are down. All the moisture we pumped into the atmosphere allowed the dust particles to bind into bigger grains, which aren't so easily transported by the wind."
"Very good," Sylvestre applauded. "Pity it's still such a miserable hellhole."
He palmed the mask to his face and waited for the door to open. A moderate wind was blowing, no more than a stinging abrasion. They dashed across the ground. The aircraft was a welcome oasis of space and quiet, its sumptuous interior outfitted in governmental purple. The occupants of the other two cars boarded by a different door, Sylvestre catching a glimpse of Nils Girardieu crossing the apron. Girardieu walked with a swaying motion that began somewhere near his shoulders, like a pair of architect's dividers being walked across a drawing board, point to point. There was a momentum to him, like a glacier compressed into a man's volume. The leader vanished out of sight, and then a few minutes later, the visible edge of the closest wing turned violet, enveloped in a nimbus of excited ions, and the aircraft climbed from the apron. Sylvestre sketched a window for himself and watched Cuvier, or Resurgam City as they now called it, grow small beneath him. It was the first time he had seen the place in its entirety since the coup, back before the statue of the French naturalist had been toppled. The old simplicity of the colony was gone. A froth of human habitation extended messily beyond the dome perimeters, air-sealed structures linked by covered roads and walkways. There were many smaller outlying domes, emerald green with plantations. Even a few undomed strips of trial organisms laid out in eye-hurting geometric patterns, waiting to be unleashed far beyond the city. They circled the city and then took off on a northerly course. Lacework canyons furled below. Occasionally they overflew a small settlement, usually just an opaque dome or streamlined shack,
the glare from the wings momentarily illuminating whatever they overflew. Mostly it was wilderness, uncrossed by road, pipe, or power line. Sylvester catnapped intermittently, waking to see tropical deserts of ice and imported tundra washing below. Presently a settlement came over the horizon, and the aircraft made loitering spirals towards the ground. Sylvester moved his window to get a better look.
I recognize this area. It's where we found the obelisk.
Yes,
Pascal said. The landscape was craggy and mostly unvegetated, the horizon ruined by uprearing broken arches and improbable rock pillars, all of which looked on the point of imminent collapse. There was little flat ground, just deep fissures, like a calcified unmade bed. They came in over a solidified lava stream, then landed on a flat, hexagonal pad, surrounded by armored surface buildings. It was only midday, yet the dust in the air attenuated the sunlight so severely that it was necessary to bathe the pad in floodlights. Militia dashed across the ground to meet the flight, hiding their eyes against the light from the aircraft's underside. Sylvester grabbed his mask, regarded it disdainfully, then left it on the seat. He needed no help making it the short distance to the building, and if he did, no one was going to know about it. The militia escorted him into the shack. It was years since Sylvester had been this close to Girardieu. He was shocked at how small his adversary now seemed. Girardieu was built like some piece of squat mining machinery. He looked capable of scrabbling his way through solid basalt. His red hair was short and wire-like, sprinkled with white. His eyes were wide and quizzical, like a startled Pekingese pup.
"Strange allegiances," he said, as one of the guards sealed the door behind them. "Who'd have thought you and I would ever find ourselves with so much in common, then?"
"Less than you imagine," Sylvester said. Girardieu led the team forward through a ribbed corridor lined with discarded machines, grimed beyond recognition.
"I suppose you're wondering what all this is about."
"I have my suspicions."
Girardieu's laughter boomed off the derelict equipment around them.
"Remember that obelisk they dug up hereabouts? Of course, it was you who pointed out the phenomenological difficulty with the TE dating method used on the rock."
"Yes,"
Sylvester said tartly. The implications of the TE dating had been enormous. No natural crystalline structure was ever completely perfect in its lattice geometry. There would always be gaps in the lattice where the atoms were missing, and in those holes, electrons would gradually build up over time, knocked out of the rest of the lattice by cosmic ray bombardments and natural radioactivity. Since the holes tended to fill up with electrons at a steady rate, the number of trapped electrons provided a dating method which could be used on inorganic artifacts. There was a catch, of course. The TE method was only useful if the traps had been emptied at some point in the past. Luckily, firing or exposure to light was enough to bleach, empty, the outermost traps in the crystal. TE analysis of the obelisk had shown that all the surface layer traps had been bleached at the same time, which happened to be 999,000 years earlier, within the errors of the measurement. Only something like the event could have bleached an object as large as the obelisk. There was nothing new in this. Thousands of Amarantin artifacts had been dated back to the event using the same technique, but none of them had been buried deliberately. The obelisk, on the other hand, had been emplaced deliberately in a stone sarcophagus after it had been bleached. After the event. Even in the new regime, this realization had been enough to draw attention to the obelisk. It had stimulated renewed interest in the inscriptions over the last year. On his own, Sylvester's interpretation had been sketchy at best. But now what remained of the archaeological community came to his aid. There was a new freedom in Cuvier. Girardieu's regime had relaxed some of its prescriptions on Amarantine research, even as the True Path opposition grew more fanatical. Strange allegiances, as Girardieu had said.
"Once we had an idea of what the obelisk was telling us," Girardieu said, "we sectioned the whole area and excavated down 60 or 70 meters. We found dozens more of them, all bleached prior to burial, all carrying basically the same inscriptions. It isn't a record of something that happened in this area at all. It's a record of something buried here. Something big, Sylvester said. Something they must have planned before the event. Perhaps even buried before it, and then placed the marker afterwards. The last cultural act of a society poised on annihilation. Just how big, Girardio?
Very.
And then Girardio told him how they had surveyed the area first using an array of thumpers, devices for generating ground-penetrating Rayleigh waves, sensitive to the density of buried objects. They'd had to use the largest thumpers, Girardio said, which meant that the depth of the object had to be at the extreme range of the technique, hundreds of meters down. Later they had brought in the colony's most sensitive imaging gravitometers, and only then had they gained any idea of what it was they were seeking. It was nothing small. Is this dig connected with the inundationist program?
Completely independent. Pure science, in other worlds. Does that surprise you? I always promised we'd never abandon the Amaranthine studies. Maybe if you'd believed me all those years ago, we'd be working together now, opposing the true pathers, the real enemy.
Sylvester said, You showed no interest in the Amaranthine until the obelisk was discovered.
But that scared you, didn't it?
Because for once it was incontrovertible evidence, nothing I could affect or manipulated. For once you had to allow the possibility that I might have been right all along. They stepped into a capacious elevator, outfitted with plush seats, inundationist aquitaines on the walls. A thick metal door hummed shut. One of Girardio's aides flipped open a panel and palmed a button. The floor fell away sickeningly, their bodies only sluggishly catching up.
How far down are we going?
Not far, Girardio said. Only a couple of kilometers. When Curie awakened, they had already left orbit around Yellowstone. She could see the planet through a porthole in her quarters, much smaller than it had looked before. The region around Chasm City was a freckle on the surface. The rust belt was only a tawny smoke ring, too far away for any of its component structures to be visible. There would be no stopping the ship now. It would accelerate steadily at 1G until it had left the Epsilon Eridani system completely, and it would not stop accelerating until it was moving barely a whisker below the speed of light. It was no accident that they called these vessels light huggers. She had been tricked.
It's a complication, the mademoiselle said, after long minutes of silence, but no more than that.
Curie rubbed at the painful lump on her skull where the Komuso, Sajaki was his name, she now knew, had knocked her out with his shakuhachi.
What do you mean, a complication? She shouted. They've kidnapped me, you stupid bitch.
Keep your voice down, dear girl.
They don't know about me now, and there's no reason they have to in the future.
The entoptic image smiled jaggedly.
In fact, I'm probably your best friend right now. You should do your best to safeguard our mutual secret.
She examined her fingernails.
Now, let's approach this rationally. What was our objective?
You know damn well.
Yes,
you were to infiltrate this crew and travel with them to research them. What is now your status?
The Volyova bitch keeps calling me her recruit.
In other words, your infiltration has been spectacularly successful. She was strolling nonchalantly around the room now, one hand on her hip, the other tapping an index finger against her lower lip.
And where exactly are we now headed?
I've no reason to suspect it isn't still Resurgam. So in all the essential details, nothing has happened to compromise the mission.
Curie wanted to strangle the woman, except it would have been like strangling a mirage.
Has it occurred to you that they might have their own agenda? You know what Volyova said just before I was knocked out? She said I was the new gunnery officer.
What do you suppose she meant by that?
It explains why they were looking for military experience in your background.
And what if I don't go along with her plans?
I doubt it matters to her.
The mademoiselle stopped her strolling, adopting an expression of seriousness from her internal compendium of facial modes.
They're ultras, you see. Ultras have access to technologies considered taboo on colony worlds.
Such as? Instruments for manipulating loyalty might be among them. But thanks for giving me this important information well in advance.
Don't worry. I always knew there was a chance of this.
The mademoiselle paused and touched the side of her own head.
I took precautions accordingly.
That's a relief. The implant I put inside you will fabricate antigens for their neural medicines. More than that, it will also broadcast subliminal reinforcement messages into your subconscious mind. Volyova's loyalty therapies will be completely neutralized. So why bother even telling me this is going to happen?
Because, dear girl, once Volyova begins the treatment, you'll have to let her think it's working.
The descent took only a few minutes. The air pressure and temperature stabilized at surface normal. The shaft which the car descended was walled in diamond, 10 meters wide. Occasionally there were recesses, stash holes for equipment or small operation shacks, or switching points, where two elevators could squeeze past one another before continuing their journeys. Servitors were working the diamond, extruding it in atomic thickness filaments from spinnerets. The filaments zipped neatly into place under the action of protonized molecular machines. Looking through the glass ceiling, the faintly translucent shaft seemed to reach towards infinity.
"Why didn't you tell me you'd found this?" Sylvester asked. "You must have been here for months at the very least. Let's just say your input wasn't critical," Girardieu said, and then added, "until now, that is."
At the shaft's bottom, they exited into another corridor, silver-clad, cleaner and cooler than the one they had walked through at ground level. Windows along its length offered glimpses into a disarmingly large cavern filled with geodesic scaffolding and industrial structures. Sylvester was able to freeze-frame the view with his eyes, then do some image processing and expand the captured view when he was 10 paces further along the corridor. For that he offered grudging thanks to Calvin. What he saw was enough to quicken his heartbeat. Now they pushed through a pair of armored doors, ghosted by security entoptics, writhing snakes which seemed to hiss and spit at the group. They trooped on through into an anteroom, with another set of doors at the far end, flanked by militia. Girardieu waved them aside, then turned to Sylvestre. The roundness of his eyes, the Pekingese aspect of his features, suddenly made him think of a painted Japanese devil on the point of belching fire.
"Now this," Girardieu said, "is where you either ask for your money back or stand in awed silence."
"Impress me," Sylvestre said, with as much droll nonchalance as he could muster, despite his racing pulse and feverish internal excitement. Girardieu opened the rear doors. They walked into a room half the size of the freight elevator, empty apart from a row of simple escritoires inlaid into the wall. A headset and wraparound mic lay on one of them, next to a compad displaying pencil-sketch engineering diagrams. The walls sloped outwards, the area of the ceiling greater than the floor. Combined with the huge glass windows, set in 3 of the walls, it made Sylvestre feel as if he was in the gondola of an airship, cruising under a starless night sky across an unnavigated ocean. Girardieu killed the lights, enabling them to see what lay beyond the glass. Floods swung from the roof of the chamber beyond, curving down towards the amaranthine object which lay below. It was emerging from one nearly sheer wall of the cave, a hemisphere of pure black, hemmed by gantries and geodesic scaffolding. Scabrous lumps of hardened magma still clung to it, yet across the large areas where the magma had been chipped away, the thing was as smooth and dark as obsidian. The underlying shape was spherical, at least 400 meters wide, although more than half still lay entombed.
"You know who made this?" Girardieu said, finally whispering.
He did not wait for an answer.
"It's older than human language, but my goddamn wedding ring has more scratches on it."
Girardieu led the party back to the elevator shaft for the final short descent down to the operations floor of the hollowed-out chamber. The ride lasted no more than 30 seconds, but for Sylvestre it seemed like a grindingly slow Homeric odyssey. The object felt like his own personal prize, as hard-won as if he had unearthed it with his own bloodied fingernails. It loomed over them now, its curved rock-encrusted side jutting unsupported into the air. There was a faint groove scored around the object,
running obliquely from one side to the other. It looked like little more than a shallow hairline fracture from where he was, but it was a meter or so wide, and probably just as deep. Girardio led them into the nearest chalk, a concrete structure with its own inner rooms and operations levels abutting the object. Inside they took another elevator, rising up through the building into the haze of scaffolding which erupted from it. Sylvester's stomach crawled with conflicting impulses of claustro and agoraphobia. He felt hemmed in by the unthinkable megatons of rock looming hundreds of meters over his head, while simultaneously racked with vertigo as they ascended the scaffolding high up the side of the object. Small shacks and equipment huts floated in the geodesic framework. The lift connected with one of these structures, and they trooped out into a complex of rooms, still abuzz with the afterhum of recently curtailed activity. All the warning signs and notices were decals or painted, the area too makeshift for entoptic generators. They walked over a tremoring girderwork bridge which extended through a loom of scaffolding towards the black skin of the Amarantine object. They were halfway up the object's height, level with the groove. The object no longer seemed spherical. They were too close for that. It was a single black wall, blocking their progress, as vast and depthless as the view of Lascaille's shroud, he remembered, after he had travelled from Spindrift. They walked onwards, until the bridge took them into the groove. The path immediately swung to the right. On three sides, to the left and above and below, they were hemmed in by the eerily unmarked black substance of the artifact. They walked on a trelliswork path, fixed to the underlying floor via suction pads, since the alien material was nearly frictionless. To the right was a waist-high safety railing, and then several hundred meters of nothing. Every 5 or 6 meters on the inside wall was a lamp, attached via epoxy pads, and every 20 or so meters was a panel marked with cryptic symbols. They continued along the steep incline of the groove for 3 or 4 minutes. Until Girardio brought them to a halt. The place where they had arrived was a tangled nexus of power lines, lamps, and communications consoles. The left-hand wall of the groove folded inwards here.
"Took us 5 weeks to find the way in," Girardio said. "Originally the trench was plugged by basalt. It was only after we'd chipped it all out that we found this one place where the basalt seemed to continue inwards, as if it were plugging some kind of radial tunnel which emerged in the trench. You've been busy little beavers, I can see."
"Digging it out was hard work," Girardio said. "Excavating the trench was easy by comparison, but here we had to drill and remove material through the same tiny hole. Some of us wanted to use Bowser torches to cut a few secondary tunnels in to make the job easier, but we never went that far, and our mineral-tipped drills couldn't touch the stuff."
Sylvester's scientific curiosity momentarily beat his urge to belittle Girardio's attempts at impressing him.
"You know what this material is? Basically carbon, with some iron and niobium, and a few rare metals as trace elements. But we don't know the structure. It's not simply some allotropic form of diamond we haven't invented yet, or even hyperdiamond. Maybe the top few tenths of a millimeter are close to diamond, but the stuff seems to undergo some kind of complex lattice transformation deeper down. The ultimate form, far deeper than we've yet sampled, may not even be a true crystal at all. It could be that the lattice work breaks up into trillions of carbon-heavy macromolecules, locked together in a coacting mass. Sometimes these molecules seem to work their way to the surface along lattice floors, which is the only time we see them.
You're talking as if it's purposeful. Maybe it is. Maybe the molecules are like little enzymes tooled up to repair the diamond crust when it becomes damaged.
He shrugged. But we've never isolated one of the macromolecules, or at least not in a stable form. They seem to lose coherence as soon as they're removed from the lattice. They fall apart before we can get a look inside them.
What you're describing, Sylvester said, sounds very much like a form of molecular technology.
Girardio smiled at Sylvester, seeming to acknowledge the private game in which they were enmeshed.
Except we know that the Amarantine were far too primitive for such a thing.
Of course. Of course.
Girardio smiled again, only this time to the group as a whole. Shall we forge inwards?
Navigating the tunnel system which led from the groove was trickier than Sylvester had at first imagined. He had assumed that the radial tunnel would continue inwards for the necessary distance to traverse the shell of the object, and they would then enter the thing's hollow interior. But it was not like that at all. The thing was a deliberate labyrinth. The path did progress radially, for perhaps 10 meters, but then it jerked to the left, and soon branched into multiple tunnel systems. The routes were color-coded with adhesive markers, but the coding system was too cryptic to make much sense to Sylvester. Within 5 minutes he was thoroughly disoriented, though he had the suspicion that they had not strayed very deep into the object. It was as if the tunnel system was the work of a demented maggot, which preferred the part of the apple immediately under the skin. Eventually, however, they crossed what seemed to be a regular fissure in the fabric of the object. Girardio explained that the thing was structured in a series of concentric shells. They continued to worm their way through another confusing tunnel system, while Girardio regaled them with dubious stories about the initial exploration of the object. They had known about it for 2 years, ever since Sylvester had drawn Pascal's attention to the oddity of the obelisk's burial sequence. Excavating the chamber had taken most of that time, detailed study of the object's warren-like interior only happening in the last few months. There had been a few deaths in those early days. Nothing mysterious, it eventually transpired. Just teams getting lost in unmapped sections of the labyrinth and stumbling into vertical shafts in the tunnel system where the safety flooring had not yet been fixed. One worker had starved to death when she ventured too far without laying a breadcrumb trail behind her. Servitors found her 2 weeks after she went missing. She had been wandering in a series of doodle-like circles, at times only a few minutes from the safe zones. Progress through the final concentric shell was slower and more deliberate than the four they traversed before it. They worked downwards, eventually reaching a gratifyingly horizontal stretch of tunnel, the far end of which was milky with light. Girardio spoke to his sleeve, and the light dimmed. They moved on in semi-darkness. Gradually their breathing ceased to echo from the walls as the confining space opened out. The only sound came from the labored purring of nearby air pumps.
"Hold on," Girardio said. "Here it comes."
Sylvester steeled himself for the inevitable disorientation when the lights returned. For once he did not mind Girardio's theatrics. It permitted him a sense of discovery, albeit at second hand. Of course, he alone understood this surrogacy for what it was. But he did not begrudge the others the moment. That would have been churlish, for after all, they would never know what true discovery felt like. He almost pitied them, though in that moment the sight revealed in the lights purged all normal thought. It was an alien city.